ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। सो टुडे वी आर रीडिंग फ्रॉम श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 12 चैप्टर 3 एंटाइटल द भूमि गीता टेक्स्ट नंबर 28। यदा कर्मसु काम्येषु भक्तिर्यशसि देहिनां तदा त्रेता रजो वृत्तिर् इति जानीहि बुद्धिमन्। यदा कर्मसु काम्येषु भक्तिर्यशसि देहिनां तदा त्रेता रजो वृत्तिर् इति जानीहि बुद्धिमन्। यदा कर्मसु काम्येषु भक्तिर्यशसि देहिनां तदा त्रेता रजो वृत्तिर् इति जानीहि बुद्धिमन्। Yada, when, karmasu, in duties, kamyeshu, based on selfish desire, bhakti, devotion, yashasi, in honor, dehinam, of the embodied souls, tada, then, treta, the age of treta, raja vritti, predominated by activities in the mode of passion. Iti, thus, janihi, you should understand, buddhi man, O intelligent King Parikshit. Translation by the servants of His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. O most intelligent one, when the... Let's read it first, then... O most intelligent one, when the conditioned souls are devoted to the duties but have ulterior motives and seek personal prestige, you should understand such a situation to be the age of Treta, in which the functions of passion are prominent. Translation responsibly. O most intelligent one, when the conditioned souls are devoted to the duties but have ulterior motives and seek personal prestige, you should understand such a situation to be the age of Treta, in which the functions of passion are prominent. So this verse does not have a purport. I'll continue on. Text number 29. When greed, dissatisfaction, false pride, hypocrisy, and envy become prominent, along with attraction for selfish activities, such a time is the age of Dwapar, dominated by the mixed modes of passion and ignorance. Text number 30. When there is a predominance of cheating, lying, sloth, sleepiness, violence, depression, lamentation, bewilderment, fear, and poverty, that age is Kali, the age of the mode of ignorance. Purport. In Kali Yuga, people are almost exclusively devoted to gross materialism with hardly any affinity for self-realization. Om Agyanati Mirandasya Agyananjana Shalakya Chakshana Damiyana Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Kaladhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram 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 Hare Hare. So now we are in the 12th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is entitled The Age of Deterioration. So the 12th canto mainly focuses on the age of Kali in which we are presently residing. So this chapter is entitled the Bhumi Gita, and in other words, here the earth is speaking, Mother Bhumi is speaking. And we see in the very first verse, she says that seeing the kings of this earth busy trying to conquer her, the earth herself laughed. She said, just see how these kings, who are actually playthings in the hands of death, are desiring to conquer me. So in the previous chapters, we read a lot about the kings of the past, in the past few years, the past few hundreds of years. So we can also see how Srimad Bhagavatam predicts the future. And though Srimad Bhagavatam was spoken, though it's eternal, but it was spoken 5,000 years ago, and it predicts about Chanakya, King Nanda, and all so many other dynasties which have actually come to pass with the passing of time. So, but the point is that all these kings are, Bhumi is mentioned, that they're trying to conquer her in a very futile way. And all of this is, she mentioned in the second verse, is because of their being covered by material lust. So the lust problem is very nicely explained in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, verses 36 onward. So there Arjun asked the question that what actually impels one to act sinfully, even against one's own desire. So we can see that even we might have the Shastric knowledge, but if the lust is within the heart, it actually forces us to act in very selfish ways. So sometimes people do things or activities against their own desire, even they know it is not good for them. But that is not because of the super soul residing within the heart, or that is not because of God. Sometimes people blame God. The reason they acted in such a way is because God is situated within the heart and God impelled them to act. But Krishna mentions that it is because of another cause, which is actually lust. So this lust is the perversion of love. So originally we have our love for Krishna in the spiritual world, and when that love comes in contact with the mode of passion, that is transformed into lust. And Prabhupada gives the example of how milk is transformed into yogurt when it comes in contact with sour tamarind. So you can see how yogurt is milk, but it is actually a transformation of milk. So similarly, our original loving propensity, which is to serve Krishna, that is our original constitution position, our original service attitude, when it comes in contact with the mode of passion, it is transformed into lust. So in the spiritual world, we actually see the akama spirit is manifested fully in the spiritual world. So the akama spirit means to be desireless. Desireless does not mean to be inert like a stone. So for those who are impersonalists and mayavadis, for them being desireless means to stop desiring. And Srila Prabhupada also mentioned in the Nectar of Instruction that maybe that is good for them. So because they'll stop acting and they'll stop speaking nonsense. But desirelessness for a devotee means to only desire for Krishna's satisfaction. So in the spiritual world, the akama spirit is fully manifested. And in the material world is the opposite. The material world, the kama spirit is manifested, or the sarkam, which means desire for personal selfishness. So that is actually lust. And this lust covers the knowledge of the living entity. So what is knowledge? Knowledge means that we are spirit soul, part and parcel of Krishna. So when we are contaminated by lust, that lust covers this real knowledge and bewilders the living entity. And it bewilders the living entity to the extent that the living entity does not know what is his or her real self-interest. So, and Krishna mentions that this lust resides, Krishna gives the strategic positions where lust is residing, because lust is our real enemy, and this enemy is within us. So just like we see in warfare, the most dangerous element are the spies, because the spies are residing in your country, and they actually go undetected, and they can actually cause the greatest harm and damage. So similarly, the lust is residing within us. Krishna says it is residing in the senses, the mind, and the intelligence. These are the places where lust is sitting. So if we want to conquer the enemy, we should know what is the strategic position of the enemy. And Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita is disclosing the strategic position of the enemy. So lust is actually very, very subtle. And Krishna says lust degrades into wrath. So anger can be detected very easily. If you see somebody angry, you know, it's very easy to tell this person is angry. Or such person is very greedy. It actually manifests in their activities. But of course, lust in due course of time will lead to anger. So we know it is a product of lust. But sometimes lust can go undetected. But actually, it is situated in the heart. It is in the region of the intelligence, mind, and senses. So Krishna says the way to curb this enemy is actually to regulate the senses and to engage them in devotional service. So, but in modern society, the word regulation is not very popular with people, especially regulating one's senses. Everything else is regulated, except for one's personal life. You see, there are so many regulations, the political regulations, economic regulations, social regulations, but when it comes to the personal life, that should be free of any rules and regulations. But if we actually want to curb this enemy, one has to regulate one's lifestyle. So that's why we have the four regulative principles: no meat eating, no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling. So these four regulative principles actually brings one to the human platform. If one is unable to follow the four regular principles, one is actually situated on the animalistic platform. But simply being situated on the human platform is not enough. One has to engage in the process of devotional service or vairi sadhana bhakti. And then one will be able to conquer over the lust enemy gradually. And as is mentioned, when our original love of God deteriorates into lust, it is actually very, very difficult to transform it back into love. But the process of Krishna consciousness is so powerful that one can actually transform the lust into love. Because all the propensities we have are actually coming from Krishna. So whether it's anger or lust, everything is in Krishna. But in Krishna, it is in the pure state. And when we come to the material world, it is manifested in the perverted state. So by the process of devotional service, we have to dovetail everything in Krishna's service, and by doing that we can gradually transform. So Prabhupada gives the example of with anger, Prabhupada gives the example of Hanuman. He used his anger propensity in serving Lord Ram. So he went and fought with Ravana and he burned his whole city. And similarly, lust can also be transformed into love. So lust meaning desire for personal enjoyment, selfish enjoyment. But if that is transformed into serving Krishna, into Krishna's pleasure, looking for opportunities where we can serve Krishna in different ways, then gradually that lust propensity will transform into love. So devotees are always looking for opportunities how they can serve Krishna better, how they can improve their service, or how they can find new avenues of service for Krishna's pleasure. And in that way, the lust propensity is transformed into love. So in these verses where we are at the moment, Maharaj Parikshit actually asks a couple of questions in text 16 and 17. And these verses are Shukdev Goswami's reply to his question. So there Maharaj Parikshit asks, "My Lord, how can persons living in the age of Kali rid themselves of the cumulative contamination of this age? O great sage, please explain this to me." And then he asks, "Please explain the different ages of universal history, the special qualities of each age, the duration of cosmic maintenance and destruction, and the movement of time, which is the direct representation of the Supreme Soul, the personality of Lord Vishnu." So then from verse 18 onwards, Shukdev Goswami replies to Maharaj Parikshit's questions. So the first question is, how can we rid ourselves of the contamination of the age of Kali? So Maharaj Parikshit is very compassionate. That's why he's asking this question, because that's the sign of a devotee, that a real devotee will be compassionate for the suffering of all living entities. And we see Arjun also in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 11th chapter, though Arjun is on the level of friendship with Krishna, his eternal relation with Krishna is in Sakhyaras, in friendship. But he's asking Krishna to show his universal form. And also we see in the second canto, Maharaj Parikshit inquires about the universal form of Lord Krishna. How people who cannot appreciate the personal form of Krishna, how will they make spiritual advancement? We see, because not everyone can comprehend that God has a personality, God has a form, name, characteristics, attributes, personality, paraphernalia. So those who are very contaminated, for them it's very hard to appreciate. But because Maharaj Parikshit is very compassionate, Arjuna is very compassionate, he asks for the benefits of all living entities. And there we see that how Krishna explains that, and Shukdev Goswami explains that the universal form of the Lord is because people who can't appreciate the personal form of the Lord, in order for them to develop spiritual advancement, to make spiritual advancement, they should actually begin to appreciate nature in connection with God. So whatever we see in the cosmic manifestation is actually part of the universal form. So example is given, like the trees are compared to the hair on the body of the Lord. And then the different planets situated in the universe are different parts of the body. So like we see, the sun and moon are the eyes of the Lord. And then the lower planets are the feet of the Lord and gradually rising up. And all the planetary systems constitute the different parts of the body of the universal form. So the whole idea behind that is that one will gradually become spiritualized if one begins to see things in connection to God. So like we see people who live in the country are a bit simple by nature. and they actually appreciate nature more. So if one begins to appreciate nature, thinking that, oh, God has created such beautiful nature, that these mountains are so beautiful, it is a creation of God, then one is actually making spiritual advancement. And one very gradually begins to appreciate it. One very gradually makes spiritual advancement. But of course, the whole point is to come, the whole idea behind all the processes outlined, whether it is understanding the Virat Rupa or demigod worship, or Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, the whole point is to come to the platform of Bhakti Yoga. That's the whole idea. So we see, for some people, demigod worship is recommended. So those who want very quick, fruitive results, for them, demigod worship is recommended. And in the second canto, a list, there's a whole, Shukdev Goswami gives the whole list. Okay, if you want power, you worship a certain demigod. If you want a nice husband, you worship a certain demigod. You worship Lord Shiva for certain benedictions. So there's a whole list given. And the whole idea is that, one idea behind that is that they actually accept Vedic authority. So in today's civilization, we see that they actually even don't accept demigods. People don't accept God or demigods. But the mentality is the same. Here, in the Vedic system, they are approaching demigods for fulfillment of their fruitive activities. Whereas in modern society, they're approaching the scientists to fulfill their material desires. Or they approach some powerful person to fulfill their desires. But the idea is the same. Whereas in the Vedic system, they are accepting a Vedic authority. And when they accept the Vedic authority, they'll come in contact with devotees. Or even if they read the Vedic scriptures, the Vedic scriptures glorify Krishna and they glorify the process of devotional service. And also, Vedic scriptures glorify the association of pure devotees. So the whole idea is that gradually they will come to the platform of devotional service. But of course, it's much worse that they do not accept Vedic authority and they accept the scientists as the leaders, and who actually say there's no God in control. All the planets are actually vacant. There's no one residing in them. And there's no demigods in control of the various elements of nature. So that is actually a very, very dangerous civilization, in which they are acting in total disregard to the Vedic injunctions, and they are performing basically vikarma activities. So whereas if they are performing demigod worship, or then at least that is regulated sense gratification. But of course, the whole point is that one has to eventually come to the process of Bhakti Yoga. So we see, as mentioned in the second canto, akama sarva kama va moksha kama udharati tivrena bhakti yogena purusham yajeta purusham param. So whether one is full of material desires, or whether one is free of material desires, or whether one desires liberation, one should surrender to Krishna. One should render devotional service to Krishna. So even whether one has material desires, one should still worship Krishna. Or whether one is desiring liberation. So, because desiring liberation means to merge into the rays of the body of Vishnu. So one has to see, where are the rays coming from? The rays are coming from Krishna. So might as well, you know, approach Krishna directly. Or whether one is full of material desires. So the difference between worshipping the demigods and Krishna is that when one worships the demigods, one will not, the demigods do not give one intelligence. Whereas when somebody worships Krishna, even with material desires, there is actually a difference. The difference is that Krishna will cure this lust problem when one approaches Krishna. Example is Dhruva Maharaj. His mother said, you go and worship Narayan in the forest. You want a palace bigger than your grandfather, who happens to be Brahma. So you want something greater than him. You approach Narayan. But the difference is that when one approaches Krishna, Vishnu, Narayan, that Krishna actually gives one intelligence. So then one is actually able to see that I actually do not need this. That is intelligence. Whereas when one approaches demigods, they are actually obliged to fulfill one's material desires if you are able to pay the price. It is like you go to a shop, you go to 7-Eleven or you go to the milk bar, and if you can pay the price for cigarettes or for milk or for whatever commodity you want, they will supply it to you. Whether it is good for you or not, they'll supply it to you. If you can pay the price for a pack of cigarettes, and the store owner will supply it to you. Though he knows it is not good for you, it's bad for you, but still will give it to you. Because they are actually obliged to give it. But when one approaches Krishna, Krishna actually knows what is good for us and what is not good for us. So then Krishna will fulfill our desires, but Krishna will fulfill our desires in such a way that eventually we'll get the intelligence, and then we don't want to desire for that. So that's akama sarva kamava. So whether one is sakam, one has material desires, one should still approach Krishna. So as I said before, this material world is a place where everyone is trying to fulfill their desires. And in the spiritual world is exactly the opposite, where everyone is trying to fulfill the desires of Krishna and they're getting satisfaction from that. So that's a big difference. In the material world, we try to satisfy ourselves. In the spiritual world, everyone tries to satisfy Krishna, and that's how they gain satisfaction. And we see the example of Arjun. First Arjun was saying, I do not want to fight, because of, he outlines five reasons why I don't want to fight, and that will actually satisfy me. But Krishna says, no, you fight for my pleasure. So after hearing the whole Gita, he becomes convinced and he says, now I'll actually fight for your pleasure, and that way he's automatically satisfied. So even in the process of devotional service, we can try to seek our own satisfaction in rendering the process of devotional service. But actually, we have to seek what is actually pleasing to Krishna. So that's the main principle: to perform activities for the pleasure of the Lord, and to avoid activities which give displeasure to the Lord. So that's the basic principle. So even in rendering devotional service, we have to see what is pleasing to Krishna rather than what is pleasing for us. So how do we know what is pleasing to Krishna? That's why Srila Rupa Goswami says we have to accept a bona fide spiritual master coming in the line of this succession. So the spiritual master actually regulates our activities in the process of devotional service. So whatever we do in devotional service has to be under the guidance of a spiritual master. So everything means everything. So there is nothing which cannot. That's why we have to be under guidance of devotees. So one cannot actually perform devotional service alone. We have to be in the association of devotees. Sometimes some devotees say, they're chanting 4 rounds or 8 rounds, but they're doing it alone. They don't come, or even 16 rounds. They're just doing it by themselves. They don't need to be in touch with anyone. They read the books themselves. That is nice, but it is much better if we if we place ourselves in a devotional community where we will be, where we are actually open for guidance. So that's therefore we have the Diksha Guru and the Siksha, and there are so many Siksha Gurus, because our Diksha Guru is always not residing in our local community. Our spiritual masters are actually traveling all the time. So therefore we have to accept so many, we have to also, apart from accepting guidance from a spiritual master, initiating spiritual master, we also need guidance from other spiritual masters, from Siksha Gurus who are living around us. So in verse 30 and 31 and the previous verses, many the qualities of Kali Yuga are outlined. So like where there is a predominance of cheating, lying, sloth, in other words laziness, sleepiness, violence, depression, lamentation, bewilderment, fear and poverty. So does that sound familiar? So all these are actually symptoms of the age of Kali. So it's interesting how the age of Kali appeared. Actually, we see when Arjun went to Dwarka, Maharaj Yudhishthira sent Arjun to Dwarka to inquire about the plan of the Lord, plan of Krishna. Because Krishna had killed all the demoniac kings of the world, his mission was accomplished. So Yudhishthira wanted to know what was the next plan of the Lord. And also Arjun wanted to find out about the welfare of his friends and relatives in Dwarka. So Arjun went to Dwarka and he did not return for 7 months. And then Yudhishthira Maharaj was speaking to Bhima and he was showing, he could see various ill omens. And then Maharaj Yudhishthira was pointing out, see how the seasons are irregular, the tide of time has changed, there is quarrel amongst family members, there is mistrust between husband and wife. And he outlines various symptoms of the age of Kali. And then finally Arjun returns and Arjun is very depressed, he's crying. And then Maharaj Yudhishthira tries to inquire what is the cause of his lamentation. And then he concludes that, as Narad Muni said, that now, you know, Krishna has actually disappeared. So actually Kali Yuga had started even while Krishna was here, but Kali had partially entered, but Kali was not able to exert his full influence because of Krishna's presence. So when Krishna left the planet, Kali entered. And we know, and it's also mentioned in the first canto, that how Kali entered. So Maharaj Parikshit was once hunting in the forest. Hunting in the forest, and he became hungry and thirsty. And then he entered the hermitage of this sage, Shamika Rishi? Shamika. Yeah, so he entered the hermitage of sage Shamika, and he did not receive any reception. So in the Vedic culture, if somebody comes to your house, you have to offer some kind of reception. So a very basic reception is you offer sweet words. If you don't have much, you offer sweet words, some water, a place to sit, and you inquire about them. So Maharaj Parikshit received a very cold treatment. And though he's a first class devotee of the Lord, he should not have taken offense. But again, he was covered by Krishna's yoga maya so that Srimad Bhagavatam could be spoken. As we see even with Arjun, he is a devotee. How could he be an illusion? But he was covered by Krishna's internal energy so that Bhagavad Gita could be spoken for the benefit of mankind. So similarly, Maharaj Parikshit was covered over so that Srimad Bhagavatam could be spoken. So then, because he received a very cold treatment, he garlanded the sage who was in trance with a dead snake. He put a dead snake around his shoulder. And then he left. And because he was a devotee, as he was leaving, he was thinking, did I do the right thing or not? Maybe it was not appropriate. Maybe he was in trance, maybe he was not. Maybe he's trying to avoid, he didn't want to receive someone lower than him, a kshatriya. So he was contemplating in this way. And then his son, Sringi, who was in the company of inexperienced boys, he found out. So this gossip coming on that your father has been garlanded with a dead snake. And because he was with inexperienced, uncultured boys, and because due to a lack of culture, he cursed Maharaj Parikshit. And Kali was looking for an opportunity to enter. So in this instance, because of a lack of culture, a lack of Vaishnava etiquette, Kali took this opportunity to enter. So he wrongly cursed Maharaj Parikshit. Actually, a king cannot be cursed, even if he's wrong. Srila Prabhupada gives the example of that a medical practitioner, cannot be. It's quite extreme. It's there in one of the purports that even if a medical practitioner commits a fault, you cannot curse him. You cannot take him to court like that. So because he's the king and his offense was actually insignificant, he had actually every right to ask for a reception because he's a saintly king and he has every right to ask for a glass of water and something to eat. So the Brahmin boy Sringi, who was 12 years old, because he had this Brahminical training, he was very, very powerful. And he actually cursed Maharaj Parikshit that you will die in 7 days from now. A snake bird will come and bite you. And in that way you will quit your body. So he cursed him. He cursed him like that. And when Maharaj Parikshit found out, he actually took that as a blessing. So that he can be free from... he can be free from what he faced. So that though that was a situation, that was a very negative situation, but he saw Krishna's hand in it. So similarly for us, in whatever situation we are in life, whatever circumstance we are, we should try to see Krishna's hand in that, though it might seem to be a very, very negative situation. So what could be more negative than that? Here is though within the womb he was protected by Krishna. That's why one of Maharaj Parikshit's name is Vishnu Ratha, one who was protected by the womb, in the womb, by Vishnu. So he was protected by Ashwatthama's Brahmastra. So there he was protected by Krishna, by Vishnu, and here, he's being cursed and he'll die in 7 days. So he saw Krishna's hand in both the situations. So he saw there I'm being protected by Krishna, and here Krishna wants me to die. So okay, that's fine. He didn't try to counteract the curse, though he could have done that. So in our life, we should, no matter what situation we are placed in, or whether in devotional service, or any situation we are in, we should actually try to see Krishna's hand in that how Krishna is actually trying to purify us in some way. So if we see Krishna's hand in that situation, we actually make advancement, and that we actually become stronger in Krishna consciousness. But if we don't see Krishna's hand in the situation, then we can actually commit offenses against Vaishnavas. We say, oh no, because of you I'm in this situation, or because of such and such I'm in this situation. But we should actually try to see Krishna's hand. So we see how Maharaj Parikshit, he saw Krishna's hand, that Krishna wants me to be detached from worldly affairs so that I can focus on his lotus feet. And then he enthroned his son, I think it's Janamejaya, as a very responsible king. He enthroned his son, because the duty of a kshatriya is to look after is to free the citizens from the bondage of lust. So his son was very qualified, and also he set the example how one should retire from family life and one should retire from administration, and actually in the last stage of one's life one should focus on on Krishna. So therefore, Maharaj Parikshit retired and he went to the banks of the Ganges. Jiva Goswami mentions that actually he went to the banks of the Yamuna, because we see through Delhi, Hastinapur, Yamuna flows. And there all the sages on the pretext of a place of pilgrimage, they came to the Yamuna. But actually they wanted to hear Srimad Bhagavatam, because they knew Shukdev Goswami was coming. And then Shukdev Goswami entered the scene and they all unanimously agreed that he should speak the Srimad Bhagavatam. So we see wherever devotees of the Lord are there will be glorification of the Lord. So both Shukdev Goswami and Maharaj Parikshit are actually first class devotees. Though one seems that he's entangled in worldly affairs, you know, he's the king of the planet, and the other is the typical renouncer, to the extent that he's not even wearing a piece of cloth on his body. Shukdev Goswami is fully naked, and that the less intelligent people could not understand him. So we see he was actually being followed by inexperienced women and children, and they were throwing, you know, stones on him, and they were giving him a hard time, ill names. So when Shukdev Goswami reached the assembly of all the sages, you know, this was a very high caliber of sages. There was Vyasadeva, Narad Muni, the seven great sages, all the demigods. And then when Shukdev Goswami reached, everybody stood up and bowed down. And then they thought, oh my God, what have we done, you know? Who is this personality? Everyone actually is bowing down to Shukdev Goswami. So he was a first class devotee, Shukdev Goswami. Because we know Shukdev Goswami's history, that when he came out of the womb, he was actually a liberated person. And he headed straight for the forest. And his father Vyasadeva was running after him. And Maharaj Parikshit, even from a very young age, as it is said that Krishna mentioned in the Gita, that you know, when one performs practice for process of devotional service, if one is not successful, one takes birth in a Brahmana family or a devotee family or a very aristocratic family. So we see Maharaj Parikshit was a devotee from his previous life, and he took birth in the Pandava dynasty. And right from his childhood he was actually a first class devotee. So he had dolls, and he was imitating deity worship, because the Pandavas, they had their own family deity. And so he was imitating deity worship. So we see in the lives of all great devotees, we even see in Srila Prabhupada's life how his father, Gaur Mohan, they encouraged him, because Srila Prabhupada had his own deities and he would conduct Dola Yatra, Rath Yatra festivals, and his father would encourage him, and his father would spend money lavishly so he can conduct all these festivals and distribute prasad. So we see that is a symptom of many of the great devotees. So Maharaj Parikshit was a great devotee, and so was Shukdev Goswami. So wherever such great devotees get together, there is Harikatha. There is only discussion of topics related to Krishna, because Krishna is their life and soul. In other words, there is Srimad Bhagavatam class. And so though they both are actually on the same level, one takes the position of a teacher and one takes the position of a disciple. And in that way they are. And then Maharaj Parikshit inquires from Shukdev Goswami. And so he starts off by inquiring, what is the duty of a person who is about to die, and what is the duty of people in general in all circumstances. So the reply to these questions is the rest of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So that's where actually Srimad Bhagavatam begins. So before that, all that is a prelude. And the way to counteract the age of Kali, as it's mentioned in this chapter and also in various parts of the Srimad Bhagavatam, is by hearing and chanting about Krishna. By hearing, glorifying and remembering Krishna. So it all begins, of all the nine processes of devotional service, the process of hearing is most important. And so when one pays heed to the glories of Krishna, so if we can hear nicely, then we can repeat nicely. And then we'll actually gradually be able to remember. Remember, if you hear, you repeat, and then you're able to remember. Though the age of Kali is full of all kinds of faults, as is mentioned here, and we can actually see that around us, that everything is contaminated. Everything is contaminated. But Kaler dosha nire rajan asti hi eko mahan guna kirtana deva krishna se amukta sangha param raje. Though the age of Kali is full of faults, but there's one good quality. Simply by the chanting of the holy names of the Lord, one can overcome the negative influence of the age of Kali. So we have to do that personally and try to help others in doing that. So I'll stop here. It's almost 8:30. I'll see if there are any questions, comments or corrections. Yes, Prabhupada.
When King Parikshit heard Bhagavatam,
yes.
Had it been written down then? Like the disciples gathered again and wives around here.
So when King Parikshit heard the Bhagavatam, had it been written then? Was spoken, yes. So before was spoken by Vyasadeva to Shukdev Goswami. And then Shukdev Goswami was reciting it to Maharaj Parikshit. But it was all spoken. And in that assembly, Suta Goswami was there. He heard it because his memory and intelligence was very sharp. He could retain everything and he repeated it to the sages at Naimisharani. I would think that's when it was put down to writing. Is it right, probably Ganesh? Not sure. Maybe we can. You can ask Bhanu Swami, who's coming today. Bhanu Maharaj. Yeah. Does anyone know? Yes, probably.
How do we?
How do we use greed in Krishna service? Okay. So how do we channelize greed? So greed. Okay. Actually, lust, anger, greed. These are the gateways to hell. But when it is dovetailed in Krishna service, they actually opens the doorway of liberation, the gateway of liberation. So one should be. Just like we are greedy for personal achievements, so we should be greedy to serve Krishna. How we can... So we should be very eager to do a service and greedy to look for ways how we can improve it and expand our service. We should be greedy to seek more opportunities and in helping others. And we should be greedy to hear. Yeah, and we should be eager to hear Krishna's glories and come to the classes. And we should be eager to read Prabhupada's books. And as Rupa Goswami mentioned in the Nectar of his instruction, Utsaham Nishtayet Dharyat Tattat Karma Pravartanat. What's the third line? उत्साह निष्ठा धैर्य तत्व कर्म प्रवर्तनात् संगात्यागाचरोवृत्ते षड्भिः भक्तिः प्रसिद्ध्यति. So there are six principles favorable to the execution of devotional service. So number one is being enthusiastic. So being enthusiastic means being enthusiastic in engaging in the nine items of devotional service and endeavoring with confidence. So in other words, one should have faith that Krishna will protect me in all circumstances, and Krishna will, that if I render devotional service, Krishna will look after me. That is endeavoring with confidence. And being patient, one has to be patient. So one has to be patient in executing devotional service. And Prabhupada gives the example of how he single-handedly started the Krishna consciousness movement. And initially there was not much luck, but because he was patient, people began to take it seriously. So we have to be patient in rendering our service and in preaching, so that the results will come gradually. And how Prabhupada gives the example of how a woman is very patient. When she marries, she wants a child. You know, she can't get a child immediately. She has to patiently wait for some time. Like that. And then abandoning association of non-devotees. So we have to abandon unfavorable association. Even amongst devotees, we have to associate with those who are seriously endeavoring in the process of devotional service. And we have to avoid unfavorable association. So the devotee on the second platform, he knows who is envious to Krishna and devotees, what is the position of Krishna, who is not a devotee. So one has to discriminate even in one's association. And following in the footsteps of the previous acharyas. So we have to render devotional service under the guidance of the bona fide spiritual master and following in the footsteps of the previous acharyas. So if we, these six principles lead to the success of your devotional service. It's a very important book. Yes,
what do you say? Enthusiasm is in some services, and in other services is less enthusiasm.
There's more enthusiasm in some particular service and less in others.
Yes.
Yes.
So, do you always have to be enthusiastic? How do you say enthusiastic?
Okay. So, we have our psychophysical conditional nature. So, we have a propensity to, we have a natural propensity to do certain activities. So it's classified as Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, very broadly. So we have to be engaged according to our propensities. But the main point mentioned here is we have to be enthusiastic in the nine processes of devotional service, which is hearing, chanting, remembering, and then also enthusiastic in whatever service we are assigned by authorities. So the authorities have to engage us according to our propensity, mainly. Of course, there will be services where we are not engaged according to our propensity, because there is the need of the institution also. So, but we have to be enthusiastic in both. Can't always get what we want. Yes, probably.
Can you describe this a bit more? Explain it. Tada treta rajovrittir iti jayanti
udhimah. Tada treta rajovrittir. So,
iti jayanti
udhimah. Tada means then, treta, age of treta, raja vritti, predominated by activities in the mode of passion, iti das jayanti udhimah. So the different ages are, everything is situated in the three modes of material nature. So we see this as the day is situated in the three modes. Morning is in the mode of goodness, day is in the mode of passion, night predominantly mode of ignorance. So the food is situated in the three modes. Similarly, the various ages are in different modes of nature. Satyayuga is predominantly in the mode of goodness, but of course there are the sub-ages also there. So Treta Yuga is predominantly in the mode of passion, as it is stated here. So these are the symptoms of the mode of passion which are outlined here. So you know, basically whatever we're doing, there is a motivation behind that. So there is some personal selfishness. So if there's nothing in for us, we don't do that activity. So that is, you know, personal desires, mode of passion. So the age of Dwapar is passion and ignorance, and the age of Kali is predominantly in the mode of ignorance. But of course, within all these ages, there are bubbles of other ages. So in the age of Kali, there's this bubble of the age of Satyayuga. So this is like the golden period, you know, the first 10,000 years from when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appears. The Krishna Marjana movement creates this golden age. Thank you very much. Granth Rajyam Bhagavatam Pidam. Shri Prabhupada Pidam.